Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack. Welcome back, listeners. I am starting off this episode with quotes about today's book, The County Line, by today's guest, Steve Weddle. Fans of this book are legion. Author Chris Harding Thornton calls it hilarious, tragic, thought-provoking, and relentlessly entertaining. Two-time guest of this show, Eli Craner, says The County Line is downright biblical. Scott Von Doviak calls it hugely enjoyable. I totally agree with that. And then this quote from the man himself, Sean Cosby. He says The County Line is intrinsically rooted in the soil of rural America. So all of that said, Steve Weddle, thank you so much for joining me today here on Top Shelf.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
A little bit about our guest. Steve Weddle is the author of today's book, as we said, The County Line, which was an Amazon first read selection for February of this year. And I snapped it right up. His previous book, Country Hardball, which the New York Times called downright dazzling, is a collection of connected short stories. And in fact, I'm going to find it really hard not to talk about Roy Allison, the protagonist of Country Hardball. So while you're waiting for your copy of The County Line, go back and read that one. A former newspaper editor, Steve Weddle, is the co-founder of the crime fiction collective Do Some Damage, the co-creator of the noir magazine Needle, and has taught short story writing at Lit Reactor. And as I said, here we are today to talk about his brand new book, which I am so thrilled to introduce to all of you listeners. So please, Steve, if you would, tell us all about The County Line.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That all sounds really nice, and I appreciate all the kind words that folks have said about the book. The County Line takes place in May, June, 1933, Arkansas, and is the prequel to Country Hardball. So that was 2013. And over the past 10 years, I've been working on the prequel to kind of tell the stories about how we got there, the families, the community. I'm very interested in the family, the people, and the community of Southwest Arkansas, which is where I grew up, Southwest Arkansas, Northwest Louisiana, right along the state line there. So I was very interested in the Pribbles and the Rudds and the Tomlins, which are names that exist, but people I made up. So I got to go back in time to the 30s to see how we got to Country Hardball with those folks. So I also, in researching and digging around at that time, found out a lot about outlaw camps, which I didn't know about. Bonnie and Clyde, actually, in the actual real world that exists, spent time in Columbia County in Waldo. They had stolen a car in Ruston and ended up over in Columbia County. So they did exist. And I mentioned that briefly in Country Hardball. And so that was kind of in my mind. So when I was going back to think about the 30s, which is, as you know, a fascinating time, I found that that was sort of some things that I wanted to investigate and dig into and research a little more.
What made you decide to go back with this story and set these folks, their family, their lineage back in 1933? Like, where does that come in for you?
Well, in writing Country Hardball, I did a lot of research into the families. And, you know, my family has been in that area for obviously generations. And the more I read about the history to write Country Hardball, the more I realized that there's a wealth of stories to tell. And the 1930s is just with FDR coming in and with the gangsters. You know, there were so many alive in 1933 who were dead or jailed by 1934. So that kind of that year itself, and especially the summer of 1933, you know, you got the Union Station massacre up in Kansas City, which I think ended up mentioned in The County Line in passing. And you got all the kidnappings. And I just kind of bumped into that, bumped up against it and said, I really want to set a thing there. I also want to set a story back in the 1870s. And there's another story that I want to tell in the 1950s. When I was working on this book, I sort of started with the idea that I would have Roy Allison investigating what happened to his grandfather, and that would take us back to the 50s. And then to tell that part of the story, we would have to learn a little bit about the 30s and then work our way back forward. What I found out in trying to do that is that, to be honest with you, I don't feel that I'm a good enough writer to pull that off. You know, it just did not work for me. And so what happened was Playboy magazine asked if I had a story I guess a year or two after Country Hardball came out, they said, do you have a story for us that we would like to run that? And I said, absolutely, I do. Here, I'll send it to you by the end of the week. I didn't have a story, right? I had nothing, but I'm not going to say no, right? It's like the Eminem song, Lose Yourself. You know, I got to take my chance, right?
This is right. You got one shot.
They come call, right? So, all right, let's go. I said, well, what am I going to do? So I found a little bit of this 1950s thing. And I said, let me see if I can turn this into a short story. And I did. And so that ran. That was Roy Allison going to Bradley, Arkansas, and then up north and kind of towards Mena, Arkansas, to find out what happened to his grandfather. And so that was the post-Country Hardball, a little story after Country Hardball. And then I had all this 1930s that I wanted to go back and tell. So I just really started focusing on the 1930s as its own story as best I could. And it got really, really big, though. It got huge. I started everything, well, I think like a lot of authors, everything that I run up against has to go into the book, right? So if I saw this and I'm researching this and I started paring it back. And so what I ended up with was this 1930s book about the outlaw camp. And I have an entire other 1930s book about something completely different that I'm finishing up now. So it's a lot of 1930s going on in my brain.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful for me. It's wonderful for the readers. Obviously, that's why it was a first pick for February for Amazon. It's incredible. I had no idea about these outlaw camps, like you're saying.
It was all over the country. They were moving from, and I think I addressed this in the book, they were moving from robbing banks to kidnapping. Scion was kidnapped and held up in the Minnesota area. They would take people and they would move them. There were a lot of people being held in cabins on fishing lakes in Wisconsin. So kidnapping was a big, big way to make money when money starts leaving the banks.
I was just going to say, where else can they turn to for crime? Right.
So they were kidnapping the thing. And so I really found that fascinating. The idea of how they held people in these areas for a while and then brought them back they would hide them out in Oklahoma, Wisconsin, all over the country. And these were big gangstery level people. And of course, you know, there were small time thugs too, but it was quite the epidemic. There are books mentioned, and I think I'm talking about this in the acknowledgments, and there's a list of research on my website, books about this time period and the kidnapping and how prevalent it was.
Your website does a terrific job of providing all of the sources, the resources that you used for the county line this period. Like you said, 1933 America is such a snapshot because the next year, a lot of that, either somebody is dead or whatever the situation is. I love the period-specific references. You've got the baseball players of the time, which I was completely fascinated. I looked them up and did the deep dive. You mentioned Bonnie and Clyde. I love the reference to the Kissing Bandit. And then you've got John Dillinger. When I think about all of these people, and then at one point, Beans talks about Howard Carter. They're talking about the current events of their time period.
Right, yeah.
So that put me in that time period. When you mentioned earlier that, you know, authors run up against things and then they have to actually put them in the book, was there anything you left out? Because they're perfectly placed in the book. I don't know, that's why you're an author and I'm not, but I don't know how you know to put those references in and have it be successful for the reader.
Well, thanks. One of the things that I've tried to keep in mind is that everything that's popular now will not be popular in 100 years. So there are things and names and magazine articles. I spent, and I'm going to estimate here, about $8 billion on eBay getting old, you know, farmer magazines and old diaries and just the things that aren't in print anymore, and reading about what people were talking about to get the language and the dialogue and things right, but also to get the details right of what was going on, because those things that people were reading then, listening to then, we may not remember, or they may not be the sort of thing that pop up on your Spotify playlist now. So a Frank Owen story, for example, I don't know who Frank Owen is. Never heard of Frank Owen before in my life. Maybe I should have. I don't know. So when I go back and I'm looking and seeing what was in Black Mask magazine or some other magazine, and here's kind of a thing. We're talking about Southwest Arkansas, rural Arkansas. We're not talking about New York City, Chicago, New Orleans even. So the things that you look back and say, what happened, what was popular, what movie came out, in, say, May of 1933, or what song was popular, it might not have, quote unquote, reached mm-hmm. Southwest Arkansas for another 6 months or 9 months or whatever. So I had to keep that in mind. So I couldn't go back and just look to see what was popular in May of 1933. So I kind of looked back at 32, 31, that sort of thing, and figured sometimes things take a little longer to get where I grew up. So I had to keep all that in mind. But the songs, the details, I wanted to mention kind of in passing. You mentioned Howard Carter. It's not as if there's a chapter devoted to mm-hmm. Howard Carter. They right. just mentioned in passing, or they mentioned, I think, the Denver Mint bank robbery, just kind of in passing to move things forward. I'm in a writer group of really smart people called the 5 a.m. Writers Club. And one of the things that one of them mentioned in one of our chats the other day was the idea that you don't always have to keep the story moving forward, but you have to keep the reader moving forward. Mm. And I like to do both, of course, but sometimes, you know, you just kind of move the reader forward and you're going and you're going. And so I found that a lot of those details really helped. I appreciate your saying that, because that's, of course, the attempt to place the people in the story and kind of get you lost in that without really bogging you down mm-hmm. in a lot of detail, so that it's just kind of the sound, the beautiful melodic leitmotif that carries you through, right?
Realizing that this camp and all of the cast of characters that are in that camp and in the same universe, Bonnie and Clyde, are not, you know, further down the road. Like, it just made it was really, I love that you did that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. The baseball references were great. I really like those.
Well, my original idea, Travis Jackson is a real baseball player yep. who is from the area. And I thought it would be cool to have, like, each chapter, each couple of chapters, kind of anchor in time with a baseball game they were listening to on the radio. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, did you hear? You know, he got two doubles the night before, whatever. But I came to find out in researching it that the baseball radio broadcasts weren't really reaching or getting to that area at that time. It would be another year or two, perhaps if you were in Little Rock. Mm-hmm. So it didn't quite work out. So I was really disappointed, because I thought I had something really clever there with the baseball players. As you know, from having read Country Hardball, I'm a big fan of baseball. Mm-hmm. And so it was nice to kind of work in some of that Travis Jackson stuff with the baseball things in there, too, in passing.
It was great. I really enjoyed those little glimpses into America during that time period. Let's talk about Cottonmouth Tomlin, shall we?
He's Yes, ma'am.
He is something else, that guy. We watch him develop over the course of the book in such interesting and humorous ways. He is so complex. He's so, I don't know, I run out of words, but early on we get from Cottonmouth, it was good to be home, he told himself. He kept telling himself that, hoping it would stick. And that's where he is right at the beginning of the book. Talk about writing him, and was Cottonmouth always going to be his name?
No, the second part first, because it's easier.
Yep.
Cottonmouth was not always going to be his name. His first name was Fed, because I have a family, and a guy named Fed, and I thought, well, that'd be a nice name. Fed sounds like a nice, old, easy name. But then I kept running into the problem of Fed said, and then Fed said, and Fed said. Well, I said, well, that ain't going to work. I changed that. So then I changed it to Caleb, because I thought that was a nice kind of family, vaguely biblical, you know, nice old sounding name. And then when I realized Caleb was, you know, I liked the name, but Cottonmouth struck, because I wanted kind of a nickname, kind of a name, kind of something to make him sound tough. Although the Cottonmouth, of course, the snake, and I wanted to build that coming in. And when he starts the book, he thinks he's super smart. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got that arrogance. He's coming back. He went off and he lived a little bit, and he's gone to Honduras, and he worked with the army and the banana plantations and all that kind of stuff, ran guns. And he came back, and his uncle has passed away. And his uncle was not in earlier drafts of the book. His uncle was alive. Actually, in earlier books, it was his camp the whole way, Cottonmouth's camp the whole way. But then I wanted to kind of remove him and had his uncle there. So his uncle was a foil to him, because the uncle was really tied to the thing and had left. But for Cottonmouth to make the mistakes that he ends up making, I had to remove the uncle. And so I tried sending the uncle off on a quest to buy some guns in East Texas. And I thought, that's great. but I don't want to have to bring him back. You know, that didn't work with the way that I was working on the plot. So I just killed him off. As they say in the Christmas Carol, you know, Marley was dead to begin with. Right.
Yes.
So, you know, Uncle Murray was dead to begin with. So that's what I did there. But so Cottonmouth starts off being Eric coming back after his uncle has passed away to take over the camp. And I'm going to show these like local yokels how it's done. I came from here. I went out, I've improved myself. I got all these, you know, these dumb people from my hometown. So I'm going to show them how it does. I'm the tough, smart guy now. And, you know, it does not work out that way as well as shouldn't. Because, you know, there are people in the community who are much better at things than he is. And so he finds out he has to really adjust the thing, which is good because one of the things I really care about in writing is community. What it means to find your place in community. And, you know, Henrietta Rudd mentions to him about finding your place in the community. And so I think that that's something that really appeals to me. It's something that I like to investigate.
He was just great. I really enjoyed reading him. And then, like you mentioned, this community. So we've got these ensemble characters, Jimmy, Beans, and oh my gosh, Beans and his chocolate pie. I don't want to say anything beyond that. There's a lot of dark humor, but very funny humor in all of that. And you've got the sheriff, Deputy Dolson, Monkey Pribble, my goodness. These men all have their agendas. They all have their nefarious ways. They are all great to read. I mean, talk about moving that narrative along. But then you give us the women in the book, and you just mentioned it. For the time period, women are very strong and independent in this book. The Rudd sisters, Henrietta and Abigail, they are a power duo. I don't know what else to say about them without giving too much away. And Henrietta, she has some really interesting thoughts. She has thoughts about being an outlaw and what that really means. That was captivating, that whole scene when she's explaining that situation. Boy, was that enlightening. Now, talk about those sisters. Were they part of the story when you started writing? Were they brothers at the beginning? Were they always going to be women?
No, they were always going to be women because I grew up around a lot of strong women, you know, and when I go back and read family histories and read diaries and read journals, as you know, the universe is full of strong women. And so I wanted to make sure that I presented a real kind of full picture of the community there. You know, I always had in the back of my mind when you see, let's say, an actress of a certain age mm-hmm. being interviewed. And, you know, they're talking about how there are no parts for women once they go over a certain age and things like that. And I think, why? That makes no sense to me because there's so many great characters and people. So the Rudd sisters, they were always the Rudd sisters. They came out, you know, not exactly fully formed, but that they were never brothers. There were a lot of things in the book that took me a long time to get to. But when I realized Henrietta Rudd, who she was, I said, oh my God, she is it. Because when I'm writing about Henrietta Rudd, I think of it in terms of this is her book, you know, because 30,000 feet is a Cottonmouth Tomlin book, right? But when I'm in a chapter with Henrietta Rudd or when she's engaging with somebody, this is 100% her book. And I'm thinking about the entire book from her perspective, the community, that sort of thing. Everything else falls away. And so I'm writing her and I want her to be strong. I want her to be tough. I want her to be clever and funny and all these sorts of things. Because I want to build her up. Same thing with Lorena Whaley. Now, Lorena came late. I changed her up a number of times. She was not always an auto mechanic. And so she was a character, one of the strong female characters. She grew into that role, I suppose, or I grew her into that role, or we grew together.
Because I was going to ask with Lorena, was she, she's so dynamite. She has this unusual career, or as a merchant, I don't even know, for 1933, for her to be doing that job just seemed wonderful, fantastic, and I love that she's doing that. Did you have, like you were saying, did you have her at the beginning? Did she come in later?
She was always going to be a sort of love interest, but that was, when I was starting, that was her, you plot things out and you think about things and you need players to bounce off of each other. You need ideas to go. You need the things to progress. And so she was always going to do some of the things that she did in relationship to Cottonmouth Tomlin, but she can't just exist just in relation to another character, right? She has to be on her own. So when I'm reading about the histories, I'm reading a lot about women who took over businesses for male family members. husbands who passed away, fathers who passed away, uncles who passed away, and the women took over. Now, you know, back in the 20s and 30s, maybe there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity for a woman to start a business, you know, as easily, well, not that it's easy now, certainly was not easy then. But there were people inheriting because that was the only person to give the business to. And so I had her, you know, inherit or take over from one of her family members and then do a great job, because of course she would, because she is smart and tough, of course, too. I had versions where I did more with Miss Phoebe, who owns the restaurant. And so, you know, she and the sheriff have a relationship there. And so I built her up. But then you do all of that. And at some level, it starts to get a little unwieldy and you lose kind of the main thread. You know, you got your A story and you got your B story. You can only have so many B stories, right? So, you know, there are other stories that I want to tell with some of the other characters through there, of course. So she was one of them that I'd really like to build out a little more. But the Rudd sisters and Lorena, I've worked my tail off to try to make sure that those characters would be proud of how I presented them, if that makes any sense.
It does. And I, you know, the scenes between Lorena and Cottonmouth, when they're in the garage, there are so many, well, there's just a lot of very, and I don't know how, she suffers him, boy. You know, there were a lot of times.
Right. Sure. That's a good way of putting it. Absolutely.
She cares for him, but boy, does she suffer him. Beautifully done on the page. Absolutely wonderful. Tell me about the title of the book, because I thought, I wonder if he had any other titles in mind.
Oh, he absolutely did. The original title of the book, because as I'm writing it, I'm thinking of it as a fun sort of book. My friend Nick kindly refers to the book as a combination of William Faulkner and Elmore Leonard, mm-hmm. right? And so I really wanted the Elmore Leonard kind of motion, the movement, the going through, and, you know, the rum punch kind of stuff of like just action and dialogue. So when you name the book, sometimes it helps you understand the book a little better. So from almost the very beginning, the book was called Cottonmouth Tomlin and the Last Outlaw Camp, because that's what that was. I was like, that's how we sold it, you know? That's how I wrote it. That's how we sold it. One of the editors, David Downing, fantastic editor who worked on the book, said, hey, this isn't actually the last outlaw camp. There are other outlaw camps that they're competing with. So unless something happens, this is not the last outlaw camp. I thought, well, good gracious, you're right. It's technically not the last outlaw camp. And the publishers, the folks at Lake Union, were smart in saying that, you know, that's going to be kind of hard to fit on a thumbnail, right? and yeah, and again, it sounds like a certain kind of book.
Well, this is like an adventure kind of a story.
It does, yeah. You know, and so in that sense, you lose some of the, and I'm not at all comparing but I'm saying you lose some of the Faulknerian elements, mm-hmm. right? So I started searching around for all kinds of poems and plays and clever little phrases, because, you know, when you see a phrase, you know, a title, and it's like, it's a line from Shakespeare, mm-hmm. or it's a line from John Milton, and you're like, oh, what a great title. I'm like, that's the kind of title I want, you know? I want a clever title like that. And nothing quite worked. They were pretty highfalutin. And some of them, I guess I sort of had my head stuck on my backside and thinking that they would work. But, you know, they came up with, I did not come up with the county line. And I said, the county line? They said, yeah, because you're in the county. If you do the crime outside of the county and you come in to hide out, you're okay once you're crossing the county line. But also there are lines, quote unquote lines, within the county that you can't cross. Don't cross that line. Of course, Cottonmouth crossed it. So, you know, I was like, oh, wow, that really, the county line really works. And I started thinking about all of the old Faulkner books, you know, the Hamlet, the Town, the whatevers. And I thought, okay, you guys obviously are much better at this than I am. So the county line, I'm gonna tell everybody I thought of it. And they said, well, that's fine, whatever you want. And so, yes, the county line, that fit. And when they said it, I said, that's it, that's great.
It is perfect. I mean, it also adds a little bit of, I don't want to say seriousness or malevolence, but it certainly brings a little more seriousness to the, when you look at the cover and you see the county line, you're like, oh boy, what's going on there? So
yeah. And that cover that they did,
beautiful,
with the colors and the font and the little crease in them. I mean, I was like, wow, that is fantastic. They did a fantastic job of the cover. I was so proud of the work that they did on that, because that was absolutely beautiful.
One of my Sunday sentences I posted on Instagram with the cover of the book, and someone actually wrote and said, what an gorgeous cover that is. And I said, oh, yeah, wait till you read the book.
Again, another thing I can't take credit for. they were just amazing. And I was just glad to be along for the ride because I thought that book, I thought they did a fantastic job with that cover.
Amazing, amazing job. So now what's next for you? Is there, you mentioned a little bit earlier that there may be more in this Columbia County universe. Anything?
Absolutely.
Anything you feel comfortable sharing?
Sure. The parts that I cut out of the bigger book to kind of get to the kidnapping thing, you know, the outlaw camp, was kind of a buried treasure sort of thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Knights of the Golden Circle, but it was this kind of a conspiracy group sort of thing with Albert Pike and sort of some Mason sort of things. Right. John Wilkes Booth was rumored to have been part. And so they wanted to secede pre-Civil War, bring in Cuba and Mexico as well, and kind of make a country there. But when they found out that things weren't going to work, they started burying firepower and guns and things like that. And if you go back and you look at the accounts from the Union soldiers who were capturing a lot of the Confederate soldiers, they were surprised to find out that a lot of the Confederate soldiers didn't have guns or only had one gun. That's because they buried them before they were captured. And so there's gold there. They're buried there. And there are people who are guarding treasures now in Arkansas that have been passed on for generations. You know the Indiana Jones movie, The Last Crusade, where you see that old man? He chose poorly. Yes. You know that old man in the cave guarding the grails? Well, so there are actual people like that guarding this buried gold, this buried Confederate gold. And I thought, you're putting gold in the ground in Arkansas? My people are going to be interested in that. You know? Yes. So, there's going to be some conversations had about that. But the problem is, now do I set it just after the 33, or do I go back another 20 years, or that sort of thing? So, you know, that just to pull the curtain back a little bit, probably more than you wanted to know. But, you know, the story, now I have to figure out exactly where I want to place that in time. So that's a lot of fun because I get to research a whole new era.
And we're here for it. I'm totally here for it. I'm here
Thank
for
you.
All of it. And readers, I will urge again for you guys to go back to take a look at Country Hardball after you finish The County Line. I know that you're in the midst of writing. Any chance you have book recommendations you would like to share with listeners, things that you've read recently, anything you would like to share?
Well, yeah, there are ones that read recently in various forms, and they are coming out in the next few months. Chris Harding Thornton, who you mentioned, who said very nice things about my book, she wrote one a couple years ago, Pickard County Atlas, which was great about Nebraska. But now she's gone back into the 1930s, Nebraska, Omaha, and that one's called Little Underworld. And it is fantastic, and I think it comes out in the next month or two. Little Underworld, Chris Harding Thornton, it's fantastic. Eric Pruitt had a book out last year called Something Bad Wrong.
Oh my gosh, I love that book.
That was great.
So great.
So the sequel, which he sent to me, which I am halfway through, comes out in May, and it's called Blood Red Summer. And it is, it's one of those sort of sequels where everything that you liked in the first book gets kind of upped a little bit in the second book. And then there's new stuff in the second book that is even better. So it's like everything about the first book that you like gets improved upon or spread out or expanded upon in the second book. It's fantastic. Bobby Matthews has a collection of short stories coming out called Negative Tilt, and that should be out in March. And Kelly Garrett's new one, Missing White Woman, is fantastic.
Oh my gosh, it was so good.
I'm really looking forward to folks being able to read that one. So those are four books that are coming out soon and that I'm really looking forward to everyone else reading because I enjoyed all four of those. Those were fantastic.
Yeah, Little Underworld is on my list. All amazing choices, and I appreciate you sharing all of those with all of us. Where's the best place for people to follow along with your upcoming events or to follow along with what you're working on in general?
Sure. SteveWeddle.com. I also, after the New York Times review of Country Hardball, spent $9 and purchased downrightdazzling.com because I thought that would be hilarious. So that's easier to remember.
Yes.
I was like, if I ever get a tattoo, that's something, you know, I will drop that in conversation all the time now. I'll be out at restaurants, you know, looking for a table, and they'll say, just a table for two, Downright Dazzling. Because I will never improve upon that in my entire life.
Listen, if the New York Times says it.
Well, I'm not going to argue with them. That was, you know, those times in your life where you're like, well, this is so much better than I deserve, you know, that sort of thing.
Hardly.
Like, wow, that was that.
I mean, let's get t-shirts that just say Downright Dazzling. I have to try to refocus myself from this downright dazzling conversation. Oh my gosh. I will put all of the links to all of the things we spoke about on the podcast page for this episode. Oh my gosh, Steve, I can't thank you enough for spending the time with all of us today. Listeners, The County Line by today's guest, Steve Weddle, is on shelves right now. So please grab a copy at your local library, your local independent bookstore, and also please don't forget to look up Country Hardball. It's downright dazzling. The County Line is published by Lake Union Publishing. Steve, again, thank you so much for joining us here. This has been an absolute delight.
Well, it's been an absolute honor for me to chat with you. I enjoy your podcast, and anybody who has not heard, you know, your past episodes certainly has to subscribe to go back and listen to those, because it's my car listening all the time. I absolutely enjoy your podcast.
Thank you so much for saying that. I'm really appreciative. And honestly, I really hope if I haven't scared you away, you will come back for whatever you do next.
Sure, I'll see you again in about 10 years. How does that sound?
I don't know if I could wait that long. I'll try. If the short stories come out, put them on your website so we can check those out. Sure. But again, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. And listeners, thanks to all of you for joining both of us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Miera Broderick, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.